This is In the News for April 26, 2006. I'm Scott Verguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. First up today, out of the Chicago Tribune, Union Inroads for Migrants by Stephen Franklin, the Tribune staff reporter. At a time when the debate about the issue of migrant workers has never been louder, Baldemar Velasquez's union already may have found one answer. The short, muscular 59-year-old grandfather leads the Toledo, Ohio-based Farm Labor Organizing Committee, composed of about 8,000 undocumented workers and another 6,000 Mexicans recruited for short-term work. Velasquez's union is in the unique position of recruiting and hiring immigrant workers, negotiating their pay, and investigating grievances. In a recent case in North Carolina, the union won a $1.4 million lawsuit on behalf of workers who suffered illegal pay deductions. Never before has a U.S. union represented workers brought into the country under the H-2A temporary visa program. In February, the union joined the AFL-CIO, while union leaders praised Flock for joining their ranks. At the same time, they blasted administration and business-supported proposals for a guest worker plan that would treat thousands of immigrants as temporary workers. AFL-CIO spokeswoman Denise Mitchell said, quote, "We have been very skeptical of guest worker programs," end quote. The AFL-CIO embraces the Farm Workers Union, she explained, because it recruits the workers who join its ranks, arranges transportation for them to and from the United States, and monitors their treatment by employers. Flock intercedes if it suspects members are being abused or their rights have been infringed upon, she said. As politicians in Washington wrangled last week over proposals dealing with illegal immigrants, the AFL-CIO repeated its opposition to any agreement that does not give full rights to immigrant workers. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney said, quote, "The idea that any group of workers in America should be treated as less than equal is downright appalling," end quote. Without money, training, or following, Velasquez founded the union when he was 20 years old. He nurtured it by working as a stevedore, musician, and furniture repairman in Toledo. It took his union 20 years to win its first contract. The spark that set Velasquez on his union leader path traces back to when he and his family were migrant cucumber pickers in the Midwest. With a taint of Texas twang, Velasquez recalled standing up to a field crew boss who forced his family to work harder than others. Angry from years of watching his family's despair and humiliation on one farm after another, Velasquez, then only 12 years old, declared that no more cucumbers would be picked until they received equal treatment. The field boss promptly fired Velasquez and his family, forcing them to look elsewhere for work. Velasquez said, quote, "That taught me a lesson about a labor action. Don't do something unless you have a plan for retaliation," end quote. As a farm worker child, Velasquez said, he often felt anger and hopelessness, especially sleeping in dirty, unheated farm sheds and watching others berate his parents and then having to labor even harder when his mother and father fell sick and could not support the family. Each year, the family usually traveled the migrant stream. Moving from North Texas, he began picking berries and tomatoes when he was 6 years old. They settled in the Toledo area, Velasquez said, one winter when they could not afford to return home. They were forced to borrow money from a farmer, and it took several years to pay off their debt. Velasquez said, "I felt trapped. I felt there was no way of leaving this place." Velasquez has used his Midwestern base and his connections in Mexico to benefit his union and U.S. companies. There's much more on this in the Chicago Tribune. For more information on the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, you can go to www.floc.com. Next up, from Common Dreams News Center at commondreams.org, 6 Green Nobels to be awarded today. This is by Douglas Fisher, dated April 24th, and appeared first in the Oakland Tribune in California. Craig Williams' son was a year old when he learned the U.S. government planned to incinerate 523 tons of chemical weapons 8 miles from his home in rural Berea, Kentucky. Worried about the risk, Williams, a Vietnam veteran, pulled out his typewriter and started writing. He is still writing. Today his son is 23. The weapons, nerve and mustard gas, have not moved, but the Army has agreed to a safer, water-based process to destroy the stockpiles there and at 3 other sites throughout the country. For his efforts, Williams today is one of 6 winners of the 2006 Goldman Environmental Prize, a $125,000 award that is the highest honor of its kind for grassroots environmentalists and is often called the Green Nobel. Winners represent each of the 6 major continents. The award was founded in 1990 by San Francisco philanthropist Richard Goldman and his late wife, Rhoda Goldman, heirs to the Levi Strauss fortune. This year, all 6 Goldman winners have fought not just to protect the environment, but to force their governments to protect the voiceless rather than pander to special interests. Williams, 58, has spent 23 years fighting the Army's plans to burn the roughly 24,000 tons of obsolete chemical weapons agents stockpiled in 8 sites around the United States. The Army is slowly changing, thanks to efforts by Williams' group, the Chemical Weapons Working Group. One site's stockpile is gone, and 3 others are being nullified via a safer process. Other winners of the Green Nobel are Ann Kajir of Papua New Guinea for fighting illegal logging, Olya Malen of Ukraine for fighting a riverway in the Danube Delta, Tarcísio Feitosa da Silva of Brazil, who is also fighting illegal logging in the Amazon Basin, Yu Zhaogeng, who's from China and is fighting hydroelectric power there, Silas Kapanen Oyong-Sikor of Liberia, who's spending his life saving his country's forests. Again, this is taken from the Common Dreams News Center and originally appeared in the Oakland Tribune, written by Douglas Fisher. And now, some commentary on the Iraq War. What can one say anymore about the war in Iraq? As so-called pundits and the particular pirates in power lie, deny, or at best debate and discuss the intricacies of occupation and withdrawal, the Iraqi people continue to suffer. The death toll mounts for all engaged in, or in the way of, the violence. The question of whether or not Iraq has deteriorated into civil war seems to be only an argument in degrees and mostly the focus of academics and talking heads. The Iraqis know the civil war is a daily shifting reality. The sleight of hand of the Bush and Blair's administrations, in concert with corporate media, has been rampant from the beginning and continues on a daily basis. It is obvious now that all of this arrogance, through creating the hubbub of doubts in the minds of we, the citizens of this country, is all a massive smokescreen, a long and continuing line of leaks, freedom of information releases, truth-telling from ex-government officials, special investigations, reports from independent journalists and returning soldiers, and from Iraqis themselves, so clearly expose the truth about the lead-up to the war that only the intransigence of the administrations and apologists in both parties, coupled with massive societal denial slash apathy, can explain the continuing occupation of Iraq, the insane threats towards Iran, the gnawing fact that the Bush administration is still standing. As Congressman Dennis Kucinich has said many times, quote, "It was wrong to invade Iraq, it is wrong to stay," end quote. This simple statement addresses both the lies of the invasion, the tragic truth that occupation fuels the violence. Certainly, no one could seriously argue that security is not a major problem inside Iraq, but the presence and violence perpetrated by the occupying force is the main cause of continued death and destruction, whether directly through military actions or indirectly through occupation policies that pit factions against each other. Iraq needs the U.S. and its dwindling coalition to leave and to take its policies of privatization and other forms of economic imperialism with it. All of the permanent bases should be shut down. Plans for reparations should be drawn up. What we most need in our country may be more elusive than the Iraqis will find peace to be. We need the lessons from this government-driven and media-enabled fiasco to be discussed and learned from openly. We need an historical confession and apology from our leaders. We need the redemption that can only come from the likes of a truth commission and the stripping of power of those that planned and carried out preemptive aggression. Until we accept the facts of illegal war, war crimes, torture, murder, etc., etc., we will be lost to wandering dumbfounded into the future as redemption comes in the form of vengeance and the violence that shock and awe begets. So, then, what can one say about the Iraq War? It needs to end immediately. If we could only but feel just a part of the anguish of the Iraqi people, or the parent of a fallen soldier, or the torment of a life destroyed by war, we would fill the streets with our demands for action, and we would not stop until the truth was enshrined as a basic lesson of our history. This has been In the News for April 26, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOW LP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I'll talk to you next time.